Hi, it's Dave. In this video, I share an interview I had with Daniel Schreiber, the CEO of Lemonade Insurance. They are a fast-growing insurance company that recently went IPO earlier this year under the ticker LMND. They offer renters, homeowners, and pet insurance, and will be launching a life insurance product this quarter. The focus of my interview is to try to dig deeply into the mind of this CEO and how he thinks about his company, product, and future growth prospects. Yeah, so I've been doing kind of like a deep dive into Lemonade over the past few months, and I've like read, you know, your whole S1 filing, your whole roadshow, you know, your whole videos, interviews from you in the past few years, your co-founders, your CFO presentation at Barclays, and kind of been talking to people and trying to really understand the company from like a very kind of deep and clear place. And so I kind of want to dig deep and really try to get a grasp of how you view your company, how you view the path forward, but more specifically, like my biggest focus is, does Lemonade have like a truly far superior product than anyone else in the insurance industry? And can Lemonade sustain and grow that advantage over multiple insurance industries? Because ultimately, I think a lot of the future, right, of I think Lemonade will come down to how superior that product is and how you can grow that advantage over time. So kind of, I'm wondering to start out with, can you kind of share your thoughts on how you view Lemonade as a product compared to other insurance, but not just incumbents, but even can Lemonade be successful against other startups and other companies that are going to be trying to go digital as well?
The incumbents are very formidable players and they have many things that we don't have, right? They've got sometimes 100, 200, sometimes 300 years of data and history and brand. They've got sums of money that seem astronomical by comparison. They've got tens of millions of customers, sometimes over 100 million customers. Dedicated teams. I've got to know the CEOs of some of the largest insurance companies in the world. And I have to tell you, they're fiercely impressive people. Thoughtful, understand the impact of technology, are forward-looking and very cognizant of the threat and opportunity that technology represents. So I certainly don't want to sound dismissive of them. At the same time, I've had a few CEOs of genuinely the largest companies in the world say to me, Daniel, I fancy your chances more than I fancy my own. And they feel that, yes, they have a clarity of purpose and a clear lay of the land, but getting there from here seems mission impossible. And they're heirs to all of this legacy and 100 years and tens of thousands, sometimes over 100,000 employees and brokers. And I remember chatting through the challenge with one of them, and I said to him, listen, you're just the CEO. And he was a little bit startled by that. And I said, every other aspect of your organization was architected with a different thing in mind than what you think you need to do. And I challenged him. I said, can you name five companies in the history of the world that reached your stage and your scale and were able to reinvent themselves in the way that you think you need to do? And they, and not insurance companies, companies. And they couldn't. And the reason really is that so many of the things that appear to be assets from the outside, when you look at them, you know, their distribution models, their brands, their technology, actually increasingly are transforming themselves or shifting into being liabilities. So you're the CEO of a Fortune 50 insurance company, and you've got 40,000 brokers. When you took on the job, you thought that was a huge asset. Now you're not sure. Maybe that's actually an albatross around your neck and makes it more difficult to do what you think you need to do. You've got a technology stack that dates back to the 80s and swallows $1-3 billion a year, but you still can't turn it into a black box. It really is a black hole, and you just pour money into it, and it's just keeping up, and you've still got COBOL base at the bottom of it, and the engineers who designed it have retired or died, and it doesn't seem like such an asset. It really seems like something that's slowing you down rather than empowering you. You look left and right and you've got these wonderfully highly motivated people who've spent 30 years at your company and are senior levels of management, but they were groomed for legacy preservation, not for business transformation. And they're just not the right people for this mission. You wouldn't have hired them all those years ago for this. And the same is true throughout your company. And suddenly you want to hire the people that Google is hiring, but those folks don't want to come to your company. So you say, okay, I'll make some bold moves. I'll buy some companies, which doesn't work either, by the way. But then you discover they've got shareholders who just want their 5% dividend year in, year out with no volatility. And they appoint the board. And from above, you've got that. And from below, you've got this. And incredibly difficult. I won't say can't be done, but it is the classic innovator's dilemma. And there are structural reasons that make it genuinely difficult for companies that were built and optimized for the industrial revolution, stepping into the digital revolution, they're just flat-footed. And when they do try to be nimble and young and hip, sometimes it just looks silly. A year into our business, I published a blog post giving out awards for the number one copycat of lemonade. Liberty Mutual took the prize for Lulu, which was a citrusy fruit that they launched with copying our logos and our naming and our pricing and everything. And it was just, it made you feel uncomfortable. You like squirmed, like, guys, have some dignity. You're an incredible company. Do something that's authentic to you. Don't try and be a startup. That's just not what you are. So it's one of those really tough things. It's the David and Goliath. And which isn't to say I'm being dismissive of these companies. I'm not. Come back in 20 years, they'll still be here. But I fancy our chances and the chance of companies like ours more in doing what we're doing, in playing our sport. I said to one of them, if you want to beat Kasparov, you have to challenge him to a game of basketball, not to a game of chess. So it depends what game you're playing as to kind of what strengths you bring. And the game that we're playing, they're not well suited. You wouldn't architect them today to play that game. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll come back to it a bit later, but I think that the differences, as pronounced as they are today, they're not converging, they're diverging. They're becoming more pronounced over time. Large insurance companies every now and again update their software, their core systems. I don't know with what frequency, it varies from company to company, but say once a quarter, a few times a year. Yesterday we did 32 production pushes of software, 32 in one day. This month we've averaged over 20 a day, including weekends. So you just realize that as pronounced as the differences are, there's reason to believe that they become more and more pronounced over time. They don't converge, they diverge. And then you come to the newcomers, and that's a very different story. And there are some companies that are interesting and impressive. It has been surprising and to some extent disappointing to me to see that there aren't more. When we started Lemonade, we were running like hell because we assumed that everybody's behind us trying to catch us. And at some point we turn around and there's one or two players out there, but there isn't this horde of would-be Lemonade or other kind of companies out there, which is interesting. It's a prize worth fighting for, but there are not many people in the fight. So you can name three or four companies, but you probably can't name five, which is kind of shocking when it's 11% of GDP, $5 trillion industry. And I think that we're very deferential and respectful of all the different things that are being tried. But we're not bumping into insurtechs in the marketplace. We're not losing business to them today. We're much, much more focused on the incumbents than we are on the startups. And it's difficult once there are two or three names out there and they're well-funded and they've got their brand recognition out there. Those things start to create a moat. They scare away other investors. The capital requirements are non-trivial. The data feedback loop starts creating a real flywheel. That means that the longer you've been at it, the better you are, the harder it is to catch up with you. And having said all of that, kind of we spoke about incumbents, we spoke about newcomers. One of the amazing things is you don't have to believe that Lemonade alone will be successful to believe that Lemonade will be successful. This is not a winner-takes-all industry. One of the CEOs that I was chatting about earlier said to me, I congratulated them, they had an incredible quarter, and they did over $100 billion that year. And I said, oh, well done, congratulations. And he says to me, Daniel, we still only have 4% market share. And that notion that you can be a Fortune 50 company, do $100 billion, and be a bit player, just gives you a sense of the, at first approximation, unlimited nature of the insurance space. So really, we don't spend much time looking at our competition, honestly. We determine what we're going to do based on what our customers want. That sets our agenda, rather than looking ahead of us or behind us to spend too much time looking at what others are doing. This isn't ultimately a winner-takes-all business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me that a lot of Lemonade seems to be your focus on efficiency is kind of striking to me. And it seems to me that the priority that you guys place on just being as efficient as possible, kind of like taking the ideal of what would it take if we just had the most absolutely efficient process in everything we do. It kind of seems to me a little bit like that was the mindset of how you set up the company. Am I off or is that similar in lines?
No, not at all.
Okay. Because like one example is when you look at, you talk often about Lemonade being built on a digital substrate and how important that is. And when I think about that, I think most people don't realize how complicated, how convoluted, and how just a monstrous of a beast these incumbent software systems. And, you know, everything is not like a lean system that manages, you know, the sign up process or the claim process or, you know, customer service, all this stuff. But you made it a huge priority from the very beginning to have one system that was super clean, super lean, that you guys built yourself, that could handle the entire process. And to me, like, I think that's underappreciated. I think that's not that easy to do, even from a pure software, you know, standpoint. Can you kind of share a bit, like, what was your thought process, you know, as you guys were tackling that problem, and how has it been building that? Like, how much dedication, how much focus, you know, and what did it take to build what you have? And a lot of that stuff, I think people aren't seeing. All they see is the app, right? They see the sign-up process, go, okay, or the claim process, but they don't see the entire back-end software system that is running your entire operation in a way that's so lean and so efficient. So hopefully you can shed some light on that.
Sure. First of all, thanks. I don't get that question a lot, and you're absolutely right. As Shai and I were founding the company, we did the rounds of seeing the systems that are available off the shelf. And I'll share with you a story. We were getting one presentation after the other by these off-the-shelf companies that support most of the insurance companies out there. And I think on the 11th company that we met, Shai comes out. He came out of all of them kind of scratching his head because we were two people and a dog with, you know, scrambling for a seed round of funding and wanting to run to market. And basically what came out of these meetings was it's going to be an 18-month project. You have to customize these big systems and a multi-million dollar investment for the software and services that you need. And after one of the meetings, I remember Shai comes out and he says to me, Daniel, either I'm totally not getting this, either I'm just missing something huge, or I could code this on my Apple Watch while driving home this evening. Now, there was some hyperbole there because he couldn't code it on his Apple Watch while driving home that evening. But the systems that were out there, and presumably still are, may be helpful to huge legacy providers with all the complexity that they have to manage, but not one of them was right for what we wanted to build. And frankly, not one of them was customer-centric. When you come into our backend systems, we've got a system that we call Blender, and the same attention to detail, architecturally, performance, and in terms of user interface that you see in the app, all of our team sees in the backend as well. And when I'm talking to a customer, I can see everything about the customer. we didn't grow higgledy-piggledy by buying different systems and different companies and kind of combining them all, as you say, a single system. So questions that you ask customer support, marketing campaigns that you engage with, claims, policies that you had, accounts, all of it appears as a timeline, almost like a Facebook-style timeline, which doesn't exist in the industry. It may sound like, you know, obviously that's what you would do, but it isn't. You call up your insurance company and you say, hey, it's David Lee. They say, what's your policy number? They don't know who David Lee is. They know policies. They're policy-centric. And the idea that that's how you would build a company around a policy rather than around a customer was an anathema. So yes, we started from scratch. What we found, and this will tie into what you asked me and also into what you asked me before about competitive advantages. I told the team a while ago, and at the time it was forward-looking, and now I can say it's true in the rearview mirror. I said, the stuff that you see as a customer, that the press sees, that our competitors see, is the 10% of the iceberg that protrudes above the waterline. You see a playful app that will sell you insurance in a matter of seconds. You see a claims bot that will pay claims in a matter of seconds, etc. And there we do optimize for speed and efficiency, but not at the expense of customer satisfaction. We do have humans. You can speak to them. But if you don't need to, why would you want to? You just want a quick answer. The really amazing part is the 90% that you don't see. The data sets that those interactions generate, the relationships between them that become available, the web that forms from all those different interactions and the three-dimensional picture that the data presents of David or of Daniel and of the differences between us. And how with every turn of the flywheel, those become stronger and deeper and more insightful. And if you don't build the system yourself, if it's not your machine learning experts who design the algorithms, your software folks, if you don't have a single system that handles claims and customer support and policy underwriting and, then you never get to create that kind of thing. And you can't bolt it on afterwards. That has to be built, as I say, on a digital substrate. And it cuts across the company. So somebody from finance will come to me and say, Daniel, the business is growing. We need some more people to help with financial filings. We want to hire another finance associate. And I'll say to them, are you sure we need another finance associate? Maybe we need another engineer. Because maybe we can automate those things and the algorithms can find them and do it for you. And indeed, today we've got an internal bot, just like we've got internal bots, and somebody in finance who needs reports for regulators chats through Slack with our bot, says, I need claims reports from this date to that date, whatever it is. And a second later, it appears in the Excel in their Slack. And the same will be true when somebody from underwriting or other functions say, oh, we need more people. I'll say, do we need more people? Or is there something that technology can achieve? And time after time, we discover that technology can do the things, the menial tasks, and not only menial tasks, that we used to think we needed to hire people for.
I'm curious, in terms of engineers, like how many engineers do you have in your company? Are you keeping track of that?
We have about 150 people in our product organization. So that includes, most of those will be actual engineers and data scientists, and some of them are product designers, but it's something in that ballpark. Don't hold me to that number precisely, but it's sure. That ballpark.
Yeah, I remember Steve Jobs once said that, you know, the beauty or, you know, the angle of Apple is they are at the intersection of science and humanities. And oftentimes it's easier just to focus on one, you know, like for example, being very tech heavy, or another side being very artistic or humanity focused. I noticed with Lemonade, there is this like blend I'm picking up where the tech is quite amazing. And again, like you're saying, like because so much of it is under the cover, most people aren't picking it up, for example, on the app. However, like I have some software background. So when I look at your app and I'm going through the interactions, I'm like, wow, this is pretty intense. Like the backend stuff is just amazing, how you're able to, you know, process risk on the spot, you know, and not just that, not just the tech side, but then you have a humanity side where you're leading people through a very just intuitive relational process, you know, and your entire brand and whole interaction with customers has this very just kind of empathetic side that isn't very typical in a purely technical, you know, focused approach. And so I'm looking at this, I think people don't understand how difficult it is to marry these two things, to hold these two values together in one hand, because oftentimes they can be diametrically opposed. Like, how did you guys do that? Did you is that just innate values that you guys have, or what was the background behind that?
Sure. So I wrote a blog post a couple of months ago called Lemonade's Da Vinci Code. And Da Vinci in the sense of exactly the Steve Jobs notion that Steve Jobs had this, Da Vinci had it, but you're between those two, it's hard to find too many other names, where when Da Vinci saw a bird in flight, he would think about heavier than air, the physics of heavier than air flight. He'd think about the biology of wings and muscles and flapping. He'd talk about or think about the perspective of light and how it refracts, and he'd think about the art and he'd draw a beautiful painting of it all and ultimately come up with a proto-helicopter. And I said that our Da Vinci Code is my co-founder, Shai. That our true secret source is that Shai, more than any professional I've ever seen, is this rare blend of, as you say, humanities and science. And you can have a conversation with him about the chamfer of the chatbot and the hue of the pink down to the nth degree. You know, the design is really pixel perfect because Shai is that pedantic and artistic. And the wording of the text that appears in that chatbot, also, I'm the native English speaker among the two of us, but he won't let me near the text because he just has it. He just really, really gets that. Through to what it takes to develop software that will deliver that 100% precisely at scale, securely, every time, and what it takes to build an organization that can do 30 builds of that kind a day. So Shai is just an extraordinary talent, really, really extraordinary. I've worked in tech for over 20 years, worked in Silicon Valley and met Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos and a bunch of other, Eric Schmidt, all these great people. And I write there in the blog that if I could choose between any of them and Shai as my co-founder, I would choose Shai every day of the week. He's really that good. And I'm doubtful. I think at this point, I'm hopeful that it's become inculcated into the fabric of the company. And we've hired people in his image, and that now is part of the, part of the very nature of the business. But we got there through sheer force of Shai's talent.
Yeah, I noticed, I had a feeling that the more I was diving into Lemonade, I'm like, this Shai guy, I think he's underrated because the level of, technology, but then I noticed, he's into like behavioral economics, kind of the whole mentality where it's not just technology, it's also, the psychology and how people receive that. I think that also is an interesting thing where it's like, for people to compete with you, and let's say incumbents, it's not just that they have to, upgrade their stack and reinvent their stack, which is practically impossible for, multi-hundred billion dollar company who has dozens of different, systems that they didn't even build, right? And but not just that, they have to also reinvent kind of their human side, right? And how they react, and not just react, how they interact and treat the customer, right? Not as a policyholder or someone who is just, a customer, but rather as someone on the same side, someone who you're trying to help and come alongside and prioritize as the number one kind of part of your industry or your company. And that to me seems extremely difficult too. And so this two-sided approach where it's gonna be hard technologically for the incumbents to catch up, but also maybe even more importantly, the priorities or the values, and the relational side, I think it's extremely challenging.
No question. When I'm asked about kind of the threat to the incumbents, and by the way, I'm not particularly, I use it sometimes, but I'm not particularly fond of the moniker disruptor. It carries kind of negative connotations, but people think, and the grammar of the word suggests, that disruptors cause disruption. I don't believe that that's what happens. I think that disruption causes disruptors. That certainly in our case, the changes that are happening to the universe, certainly to Earth, to the planet. We are living through transformations that are stunning in their reach. You'd have to go back hundreds of years, maybe to the scientific revolution, maybe to the agricultural revolution, to see a change as big as the kinds of changes that were happening. And there it lasted much longer. We're seeing changes here that are happening at a pace that is exponential, not linear, and therefore really is without precedent in human history. And it is that rather than lemonade that threatens the incumbents. Lemonade is a phenomenon. We're trying to precipitate the wave, we're trying to ride the wave, but we're not the force. It's a secular shift. It's a systemic change in the world that means that if you are set up to be broker-based and, as you say, not customer-centric, and there are all these things that made sense in the 1800s and have carried forward, very difficult to change. You know, in my mind's eye, I liken it, and I wasn't there, so I don't know if I'm doing justice or not, but in my mind's eye, I play out a conversation around the boardroom of a big retailer circa 1995. I'll use Walmart, but they actually have done a better job than anybody else. A lot of the other names have disappeared, but let's take Walmart, for example. So in my mind, somebody comes to the board meeting of Walmart and circa 1995 and says, hey, listen, there's this new website. It's called Amazon. It's really pretty cool. And you can go on there and you can buy books, and now they're starting to sell other stuff, and maybe we should, you know, do something like that. And they think about it, they say, yeah, hey, Jimmy, you know HTML, why don't you give it a try? And they think, and actually Barron's had a famous cover piece in 1999. The headline was Amazon.bomb, where they explained that Amazon doesn't stand a chance against Walmart, and they're going to be eaten alive. As soon as Walmart turns their attention to this, Amazon is dead. And what I think they thought at the time was that Amazon is a website. And hey, Jimmy, you can make a website and we're done. Let's move on. And here I go back to this phrase that I do use about the digital substrate. And you're talking now about culture. When you build a company on a different foundation with a different focal point, customer centricity, and a different factor of production. You're not using humans, you're using data and technology as the building blocks of your business. The differences are quickly apparent, but actually they run much deeper. And I go back to my point earlier that at the end of the day, 20, 30 years later, we know that Walmart and Amazon became more and more and more different. They never closed the gap. And technology can do that in a way that nothing else really can. You know, if I told you that you can buy a cheap airplane ticket, so a low-cost airline, you would rightly assume that the chairs are going to be a little bit more crammed, they won't serve you a meal, they'll charge you for checking baggage, and the peanuts won't be quite as generous as the other guy's peanuts. Because low cost means low cost, and in our mind, that's what it means. An inferior product, but it's okay because I'm saving money. Technology has introduced this wild phenomena, which is I'm saving money for a superior product. Amazon gives me incredible service and costs me less. Uber gives me incredible service and costs me less. Airbnb gives me incredible service but costs me less. And this idea that you can crush costs, not at the expense of the product or the customer, but to the delight of the customer and at a lower cost, only technology can deliver that. And if you build a company using those building bricks, those building blocks, then over time, those things are going to manifest in more and more places and in ever more powerful ways.
Yeah, fascinating. Your comment about how disruption is actually doing the disruption, it reminds me of this idea I had a week ago where it's like, often, I think sometimes the fish bowl determines the size of the fish in a way. So in a way, what disruption is happening, technology is doing is, it's creating this huge fishbowl for those, let's say, in the insurance industry who are willing to jump into this new fishbowl of just what technology can do to provide, let's say, lower cost, better experience for the customer. And it's really the size of the fishbowl, the size of this disruption, as you've mentioned many times in past interviews, is huge. You know, this is one of the biggest industries in the entire world. And this disruption that's happening, the size of this disruptive fishbowl is just huge. And in a way, that is what is going to determine, in many ways, Not 100%, because also obviously lemonade as a company needs to execute and, you know, be the best in that fishbowl. But that fishbowl ultimately probably has the biggest role in terms of how big the fish, you know, ultimately becomes. That's kind of the example I was thinking. What do you think of that?
I agree with you. I think even mediocre companies that do some of the right things will end up being successful. I think that insurance has many companies in it that have been doing just fine for decades or centuries without being extraordinary. So there is some of that. That's not what we strive for. We strive to be extraordinary, but I think your thesis is solid.
Yeah, and I also think
it goes back to my point earlier about it's not a winner-takes-all industry. There's room for the number two and the number three and the number four.
That's true. I mean, do you think, though, in this more digital, let's say, market or disruption fishbowl, that there are some inherent things about technology that make it where it's less distributive in terms of how many companies and how just equal the pie is shared amongst many players? Meaning, even though it won't be 100% winner-takes-all market, do you think in some ways with technology and the internet and the advantages of scale that it provides, that it will be less of a diversified kind of a more concentrated market, this whole digital insurance market, than maybe existing, you know, traditional markets of insurance?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. It is looking that way. To my earlier point about, you know, where is everybody? Why aren't there 100 lemonades contending for this? It is looking that way, that it may end up being just, you know, one, two, three digital names. You know, it's interesting. And this is also goes back to your question about moats and competition. One of our early investors was Google. And a while ago, we had an interesting conversation with Eric Schmidt. And he was chatting about growing fast and capturing market share quickly. And he said that Google, in the early days, they missed out on three markets. I think, I'm not actually sure what it was. I've got a feeling it may have been China, South Korea, and maybe Russia or Ukraine or one of the Eastern European countries, I think maybe. And he said, you know, Daniel, to this day, in two out of those three markets, Google is nothing, which is amazing. It's this idea that the market may be huge, so market share isn't a problem, but mind share is an issue. And part of the reason that we at Lemonade are moving fast is I do believe that there is some wet cement where there's a placeholder for the 21st century incarnation of insurance. What does it look like? The Google of kind of thing. And if you write your name in the cement while it's wet, it endures for a long time. If you miss that opportunity and somebody else writes their name, it's a lot of hard work to try and change that. And even though insurance companies are bombarding us with ads all day long, and they've got propeller planes dragging banners and Super Bowl commercials and everything else. So we know all the names, the State Farm and the Allstate and the Farmers and, you know, all the insurance companies with the name State and Farm in their name. I still believe that there's actually a big part of the consumer's mindshare that is waiting for, okay, but what is the new version of that? And we are trying to imprint Lemonade on the consumer's mind share in order to fill that space. So we're launching new products quickly, we're launching new geographies quickly. And in that sense, I think coming full kind of circle back to your question, I'm not sure that there's room in the mind share for a lot of brands. You know, at the end of the day, you can name Google, hard to name the second player, even though it's a stunningly big market. You can name Amazon, you can name Facebook, hard to name the second and third. You name YouTube, but who knows who the next biggest player is in that space. So there may be some of those dynamics at play here as well. It would not be shocking to me.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I'm curious, I wanted to ask you about kind of first principle thinking. I've noticed in many of just your talks and your interviews and presentations, you talk about kind of how insurance ought to be and kind of what the experience ought to be if, you know, you put the customers at the priority at first place. And you talk about how an insurance company maybe ought to be built in the 21st century with technology and a digital substrate. Can you expound or share a bit more on this first principles thinking, like how it should be? Like, is this something that, you know, was from the very early stages of the company, you know, part of your DNA, and how has it kind of over time? Is it something that you guys still think about, you know, over time as well?
Yeah. When you're taking on an established anything, established competitor, industry, process, I think it's, unless you come from that space and you know it inside out, it's very hard to eke out optimization of that system better than the incumbents themselves. So if we wanted to build another AIG or State, any, you know, I'm not picking on any of those companies, if we thought we could just do, let's just do what they're doing, but do it better, I think we would lose. I really do. If you want to do it not 10% better than them, but you want to do it 10 times better than them, ironically, you stand a better chance. I don't believe you can do 10% better than them. They know their game better than you do. You will lose. 10 times better than them? Okay, now that forces you to forget everything that they're doing, because you're never going to get 10x better by doing what they're doing, and say, okay, I need to change substrate. I need to change building blocks. I need to change the whole thing. I've got to throw it all out and start from scratch. And that is the only way to get to dramatically better stuff. Geico has their wonderful commercial with 15 minutes can save you 15% or more. 15 minutes is great, but the median time to buy a policy on Lemonade is a tenth of that. It's 10 times faster. 90 seconds is literally the median time. You don't get to shave off 90% by trying to do what they're doing, but doing it better. Impossible. You've got to go back to the drawing board. The median savings for a first-time buyer of insurance on Lemonade is 50%, not 15%, 50. You don't get to do that, but you can't. You can't play back to my thing about Kasparov. You can't challenge Kasparov to chess and expect to beat him. You've got to change the game. So we knew that we're coming as outsiders to this industry. Neither Shai nor I have a background in insurance other than as consumers. And so we had to play to our strengths. We had to say, okay, what do we know? We know customer-centric innovation. We know technology. We know sharing economy. We know contemporary branding. We have a grasp of behavioral economics, and one of our founding team members is Professor Dan Ariely, the eminent behavioral economist. What can we do? How would we do it? And then you're playing to your strengths, and then you're thinking about stuff from scratch and building it up from the ground up. So it sounds like an early investor was like, go, you guys are nuts, you know, stick to your knitting, do what you do, partner with a big insurance company and just, you know, create a beautiful website. That's what you guys know how to do. And it sounded like we were taking upon ourselves the hard route of doing everything, getting our own licenses, getting our own business model, doing our own actuarial sciences. But I was convinced then, I'm even more convinced in hindsight, that it was the easier path, the less risky path, than trying to have some kind of hybrid of trying to improve on legacy. We would have failed. If we thought we knew how to do that, we would have done that. Hell, if you can find 30% improvement on a $5 trillion industry, you don't need to do anything else. I just don't believe in that. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Yeah, one of the striking things about the Lemonade story is how new you and Shai were to the insurance industry, and how, like, that struck me, because oftentimes it takes, like, you know, many, many years for people really to understand the industry that they're disrupting. And for you guys to kind of come from almost an outsider kind of perspective in tech and to try to disrupt this multi-trillion dollar, you know, global industry, it sounds very, very, you know, it's bold in the good sense. And I'm wondering though, like, as you, you know, took this on, were there some mistakes, some things that in the beginning, because you didn't have, let's say, the intimate knowledge of insurance and the industry, were there some mistakes that you just look back on and you're like, oh my gosh, we can't believe we did, you know, that in the early stages?
There are. I'll tell you one or two. I'm surprised there weren't a lot more. I think we got quite lucky as well. And there's a lot of luck in these things. There's no question. To my mind, a lot more luck than we like to credit. And for us, the stars aligned and the gods have been kind to us. But yeah, there are a few things that in retrospect, you say, wow. We set out, we said, okay, we're not going to be dependent on legacy providers. We're going to build our own insurance carrier. And everyone said to me, you're nuts. And we, we'll be okay. We were nuts. and we decided to do to get our license from the great state of New York, which is highly regarded as perhaps the most exacting regulator out of the 50 states. California give them a run for the money, but it's between the two of them. And our thinking was contrary. It was like, well, we want to build something durable, sustainable over a long time. You start, you take on the hardest challenges, and then everybody else will fall in line. You start somewhere else, you may never make it to New York. And getting our license in New York was incredibly difficult, incredibly difficult. And we had, we'd raised a ton of money by our standards. It was, you know, Sequoia was one of our seed investors. It was the largest seed round in Sequoia's history. They've been doing this since the early 70s. We've got gray hair. We've done this before. We brought on board some incredible people from the insurance industry. And we thought, okay, getting a license should be pretty straightforward. We'll fill out the paperwork. We got a top regulatory counsel. We did everything by the book. And the license didn't come, and the license didn't come, and the license didn't come. And we were really getting desperate. The money was running low. We were started to think maybe we should go to London, where they were saying, you know, come here, we'll give you a license. The story has a happy ending, and we got our license. But in retrospect, I don't think we understood how high a bar we set ourselves. We wanted to set a bar, you know, that we hoped we could clear. In retrospect, I think you flip that coin 10 times, maybe it comes up once, heads. So some of the gauntlets that we've run, at the time we were like a little bit headstrong, like, oh, it should be fine, should be fine. And in retrospect, you look back and say, crap, wow, we could have absolutely have died there. Thankfully, we didn't, but that was not smart. So there were a few of those moments for sure.
Got it. Interesting. Was going into the U.S. kind of as your first kind of big market, was that also kind of like, if we're going to have grand ambitions, we better be able to do, you know, do well in this kind of market of the U.S.?
Yeah. And something like 50 cents on the dollar of spending by consumers on insurance is done in the U.S. And first, it was really a question of New York as the financial center, California as the tech center. We settled on New York. But yeah, it was definitely our first choice. Mm-hmm. We did consider London. And if it wasn't for, I don't know if you can tell from the remnants of my accent, but I'm originally from London. And while we were waiting for New York to give us our license, I got an emissary from 10 Downing Street and actually an invitation to go to 10 Downing Street, which I did, which for me was a really exciting thing. And they said to us, come here, we are English speaking and you can face America. We're also part of the European Union. You can face Europe. It's the perfect thing. And they said, you know, next week we've got the Brexit vote, but we'll vote that down and then everything will be great. Famous last words. It didn't quite play out that way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting. What I, one of the things I'm picking up also is like having all of the foundational work of a unified kind of super lean, super efficient system that runs, you know, you're running your, all of your systems, right? Your marketing, your sign up, your application, your underwriting, your claims process, customer service is all just there. One of the interesting things is as you expand to different insurance sectors, you can take along your entire system because that's the only system you have, right? To process claims and sign up. I think like in some ways, like, you know, that makes sense, right? I mean, it's from a technological standpoint, but from the insurance industry standpoint, that's very like, you know, novel, like very, I mean, because from what I'm learning is that the insurance industry, even their separate departments are mostly siloed, different software and, you know, and everything. They're not what you would think would be like, what people would think would be like one lean industry at all. And so what kind of advantage, does that give you guys when you guys are thinking of new markets? Like, for example, when you guys decided to go into pet insurance, or now you're thinking about life insurance. Like, yeah, how does that factor into kind of your expansion plans?
Hugely. So you're absolutely right. One of the beautiful things, we launched Pet 3 months ago. One of the beautiful things is that the marginal cost for us to launch this entire new category was marginal, because it's the same policy management system, the same customer support system, the same claim systems. There's incremental work to do, but these are not entirely new companies or systems that we have to put in place. And by the way, that's true. The United States is actually almost like 50 different countries. It's regulated on a state-by-state basis, and there's its own rating engine and own compliance and everything else. And we've been able to create dozens of instantiations of the same software and even move over to Germany and Holland and very soon France. So 5 years in market, and to have that kind of footprint, you could never do that without a digital build, you know, if you weren't built on a digital infrastructure. But it goes deeper than that. I'll give you a colorful anecdote, but then I'll try and drive home the deeper point. We had an interesting case of somebody who wrote in or called, I can't remember what it is, to our customer support and said, "I'm thinking of buying renter's insurance. I have a question. If my scuba gear is stolen from my car, is that a covered peril? Is that covered?" It's an unusual question, but the answer is yes, it's covered. So he went ahead and bought a policy. And would you believe it? 2 weeks later, his scuba gear was stolen from his car. Now, insurance fraud is a real thing. But I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I think he chose the one company in the world not to try that particular trick on, because I imagine that every other insurance company in the world, for the reasons that you discussed, the customer support question would have gone to probably an outsourced team using a particular system in God knows where. And then when the claim came in, it would be an entirely different set of software, entirely different team. They'd never have any way of knowing that this particular claim had a inquiry made 3 weeks ago about this exact same thing, which, as you and I discussed, red flags go up because you realize that that is a highly suspicious set of circumstances, but nobody else would catch that. Eliminate we did for the reasons that we discussed, the customer centricity, you see these data points, and we've had example after example after example of that. So that's kind of a colorful example, or people, whatever, we've posted about it, people wearing wigs and all different other kind of fraudulent things that software picks up and that otherwise you just wouldn't. You know, at the end of the day, there's one brain doing all of these interactions and it sees these things. If you speak to one person and I speak to another person and they meet me with a wig, I wouldn't know that they spoke to you without a wig a week ago. But if we are the same person, the same intelligence, then you catch these things. But the deeper point is that not only do you catch fraud and stuff like that, but you start getting a much deeper understanding of people, of customers. And one of the things that we understood early on is that a lot of insurance is not about insuring property, it's about insuring people. And you and I could drive the identical car or live in identical homes and represent radically different risks. It's not enough to know when the plumbing was installed in our building that we both live in, or what the crime rate is in the neighborhood. We want to know whether we're the kind of people who leave the door unlocked, who turn on the alarm, who clean the gutters before winter, who don't leave candles in precarious positions in our kitchen, and all of those kinds of things. Because those are, that's, it's at that level that insurance is won or lost. Those are the competitive dynamics. Just knowing when the plumbing was built is just too crude a measure. And if you buy into that, and I'm absolutely convinced about that, that ultimately in the business of looking after people, but also understanding the inherent risk of a person, then having a multifaceted system that sees different products, different stages from the marketing through to the claims, to the churning, to the credit cards, you start creating a much richer understanding of the human being that stands in front of you. And then you can do everything better. You can sell them the right products. You can suggest the right coverages. You can pitch them a life product or not pitch them a life product without filling up their inbox with nonsense. When a claim comes, determining whether this is one that you should be paying in 3 seconds or whether there's flags and you really need a human being to be involved in this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then that's where that flywheel kind of gets more and more powerful over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I noticed I want to ask you about geographic expansion along with the same lines. I think I came across something of like you're expanding. It was one of the countries in Europe where I believe you or one of your team members were saying like you don't really have people on the ground in that country, but yet you're expanding into that country. I forget which country it was. And it kind of struck me as like, wow, that's fascinating to be able to actually expand geographically, let's say across cultures and languages in some ways, but without having like a geographic physical presence, right, in that country. Could you kind of dive into that a little more? Is that possible actually to, you know, expand geographically without physically, you know, being on the ground as an insurance company?
Yes, it is, but it is unusual. And it goes back to the kind of the fundamental differences that we've discussed. It's not the way insurance has been to date. So all the brands that we're familiar with in America stop at the water's edge. You go to the UK or to Europe, France, Germany, wherever you want to go, and you ask them about State Farm and Allstate and Geico and Progressive. They've never heard those names. And you come to the US and you talk about Generali or AXA or Allianz or some of the largest names in Europe, and we've never heard those names in America. It's kind of stunning. These huge conglomerates that stop at the water's edge and don't cross over. And part of it is there's a whole set of things, but you look at the skylines of our cities. So London has this beautiful, iconic building. It's the Swiss Re building. It's an insurance company. You think about the MetLife building in Manhattan. You think about the TransUnion building that is so iconic in the San Francisco skyline. And you think about all the great cities of the world. And you think about their skylines. And what you're really looking at in no small measure are insurance companies. They come into town. They build an iconic skyscraper and they stick 5,000 people in it. And they hope that that will confer trust because it's got this kind of powerful image. And it's a practical necessity because it's a labor intensive business. You need a lot of people. We take a different approach to the trust thing, but just sticking to the geographic expansion. In the United States, before we get to Europe, in the United States, our largest markets are Texas and California. These are the largest states. We have 0 employees in Texas and we have 0 employees in California. So we are servicing the largest states in the union without having a physical presence, without building any skyscrapers. And as we are thinking about that and the fact that it is really a digital product that we're able to resolve things from afar digitally, we realize that consumers who get attracted to the kinds of value propositions that Lemonade represents, which is good value, good values, and an amazing experience, those are universally compelling value propositions. And you think about digital brands, forget this insurance brands, but think about Spotify or Uber or Amazon. The consumers who are using them in London or in Tokyo or in Berlin or in San Francisco have more in common with each other than they do with a traditional culture that surrounds them. And these brands, or Airbnb, they don't stop at the water's edge. They are global in nature. And it is our aspiration that Lemonade should be like that. We haven't achieved that aspiration, but that is the aspiration. And logically, it feels to us that it should be doable. That the value proposition, the user experience, these are not things that are unique to one culture. These are really things that humans like and digitally native humans expect. So the combination of saying consumers want this kind of things all over the place and the costs for us of opening up Germany, back to your question, we have 0 employees in Germany. We do have employees in Holland because that's where we're licensed. That is our European headquarters. We're about to launch France with no employees in France either. So we are able to expand to new geographies and new languages without putting the skyscraper there and sticking 5,000 people in it. So, it is possible. Mm.
Interesting. I'm wondering, because to expand into another geography with a different language and even perhaps culture, etc. I'm imagining, like, you know, you need to localize, you know, the entire process, you know, from marketing, application, you know, underwriting, claims, customer service. I mean, it sounds like a pretty immense job to localize the entire product. But I imagine once you localize once or twice, then you start the flywheel or the wheel starts to kick in where you're like, huh, okay, this actually is, you know, to do your fourth or fifth or your 10th or 20th is a lot easier. Are you guys building that type of, I'm assuming that everything is in-house, you know, built on your system. Mm-hmm. Like, are you guys kind of catching that sense that, hey, you know, this localization, we can, you know, expand this quite, you know, large with our existing system?
Yes. So it's all done on the same system and it's all done in-house. And the big difference isn't technological, because translating is not a big effort when you build the software right. It is regulatory, for one. So the licenses that we have in the US don't translate over to Europe. And there, Europe is actually simpler. The regulation is less cumbersome from our perspective than the American regulation. And remarkably, all 28 countries of the European Union have a single regulatory framework. So actually, there's a lot bigger differences between New Jersey, Connecticut, and New York in terms of regulation than there is between France, Germany, and Holland. So the languages may be different, the competitive dynamics may be different, but the one license that we have allows us to operate in each of those geographies more freely than we could moving from one state to the other in the United States. That said, I don't want to underplay the local dynamics. Each country there, and this is where it's different to the United States, each country has its own competitors, its own not only language, but customer expectations and priorities. And its quirks. You know, we launched in Germany. And so when you buy Lemonade Insurance in the US, you download our app, you go to our website and you chat to Maya and she says, hi, I'm Maya, what's your name? And you say, oh, Dave, and you move on. It took us a while to figure out what was getting stuck. But in Germany, people took exception to Maya being so forward. Like, I don't know you yet. What are you asking me my name for? And we found that we had to move that question to the end of the process. When you're ready to buy, then we've earned your trust, and now you're willing to give us your name. But when we put it up front, people got upset about that. So we are finding that the different European countries have different challenges, and we haven't cracked them yet. We still have a lot of work to do. We are still America-focused. So we are, for reasons that we discussed earlier, we are launching and mapping out territory really across the globe and across Europe at the moment. But we're still a tiny company. We've got, you know, 500 employees, about 1 million customers, but 500 employees. So we do have a rather rigorous process of prioritizing our time and our money. And at the moment, America beats out the European countries in terms of the return on the incremental minute or dollar. And that's where most of our attention is.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I'm curious, does being based or headquartered in Israel, does it help, do you think, your company have a maybe more global perspective on things? Because I noticed, like, also with Lemonade, it's like my typical, when I would be looking at a company, like, you guys are expanding quite fast outside of, you know, just the US into Europe. And it struck me as, like, a bit different. You know, I feel like most insurance companies seem to be very domestically focused, you know, but it seems like there's something in the DNA of Lemonade that's a little bit different, that maybe sees things a bit more globally than others might. Can you speak to that a bit? I mean, is there some type of more global type of perspective that you guys have? And do you think that's an advantage when you are looking at the world?
So the company is actually headquartered in Manhattan, but from day one, we've been live in locations, both in Tel Aviv, where we do our product, our R&D work, and New York, which is where our commercial and insurance operation lies. Which means that from day one, we were thinking about transatlantic communication and transatlantic travel. And certainly, while I've lived on multiple occasions in the US, not coming from the US, And having a perspective from the UK and from Israel and from America certainly makes me feel more like a kind of citizen of the world. And I think that, yes, a lot of people who grow up in the centers in America, because America has so much to offer, can sometimes be more parochial in their vision, think about their business. Whereas if you're in London, and certainly if you're in Tel Aviv, you must be thinking about export-oriented businesses, because there is no domestic market in Israel to speak of. So it's definitely been part of our mix in a way that I imagine had we all just been Native Americans born and bred in one of the great cities of America, it may have come less naturally to us. Mm-hmm.
How many people do you have in Israel versus, like, say, your, you know, New York office, et cetera, worldwide?
We have somewhere between 150 and 200 people in Tel Aviv. We have, I'd have to say, something similar in Manhattan. It's lost its significance over the recent months because for the last 9 months, nobody's been at any office. So I've stopped, everyone's working from home. So I've stopped kind of keeping count of these things. We have a growing operation out of Scottsdale, Arizona, which is where we do a lot of our customer support and our claims operation. And we have a small team out of Holland, Amsterdam. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. I want to dive into your brain and your thought process of how you're expanding across not just geography, but now let's say different insurance sectors. And so your first, you know, product entrance was the renter's insurance. And I'm curious, like, was it mostly because it's like an unloved kind of sector? There was a lot of opportunity, a great chance to get into kind of a starting a foothold and then to grow your presence. And then it was pet a similar type of thought process. And then I'm curious, just, you know, you've recently announced, you've been getting into home insurance and now you've announced getting into life insurance. So kind of what is your thought process in terms of, you know, expanding across sectors?
Sure. We were selling homeowners insurance from the very first day that we launched. So September 2016, we launched in New York with renters, condo, and home insurance. But renters really was the focus. Generally going into homeowners insurance was because it seemed to be relatively neglected. So it was a stunningly big business. In the US alone, you're talking about something like $100 billion a year is spent on homeowners insurance. But it was almost like a backwater compared to other. Auto had achieved a lot more direct to consumer. You think about Geico, Progressive. Homeowners insurance was still 95, 96% broker based. So it was a contrarian approach, trying to look for places where the potential and the actual were as divergent as possible, because that's the breach you want to get in. And as we entered it, we did find that with renters in particular, it was really playing to our strengths. A lot of the things that we could do, selling policies inexpensively, targeting young consumers, turning insurance from a conscious sales process to almost an impulse buy by presenting it on a Facebook ad and other kind of communications. We found that this was an area, even within homeowners, that was just really neglected. And those consumers, those up-and-coming, amazing young consumers buying insurance for the first time, we think of them as just an incredible cohort of customers we feel privileged to serve them. But they were of very low interest to the incumbents. The premiums are very low. The cost to serve for them with a broker just doesn't make sense, given that the premiums are so low. So the whole system was not optimized for that consumer. So for us, that was incredible. About 90% of our customers are first-time buyers of insurance. And our market share among first-time buyers of insurance is pretty remarkable, just a few years in market. But from early on, really from the get-go, we knew that what we want to do is use that advantage to acquire customers at a time that they don't want to deal with incumbents and incumbents don't frankly want to deal with them. And we're competing with non-consumption, which is incredibly powerful. But then how do we grow with those customers? Because insurance is so extraordinary in that the lifetime value is just an order of magnitude or more than what you think about typically. So you may have a view on Peloton, may think it's an amazing company. I don't know what your views are on this, but you'd at least ask yourself the question of whether people are still going to be riding bikes in their home 5 years from now. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. You won't ask yourself whether they'll be insuring their home 5 years from now. They absolutely will. And I don't know whether a cohort of Peloton customers today will be spending more or less on Peloton in 5 years. I do know that a cohort of insurance buyers will be spending more 5 years. And not 10% more, 20% more, but quite possibly 10 times more. If you got them early enough and they're buying a $60 policy, you know that they're going to go from 60 to 600 to 6,000 as they layer on top more insurance needs. And insurance really tracks the kind of the GDP of the individual, your net worth. And as your net worth increases, your life's responsibilities increase, your insurance needs really move in lockstep with that. So for us, it was always about how do we earn the right to provide all the services that our customers want. And in areas that we didn't provide them, we felt that we were letting them down. We get a lot of inquiries about products we don't have. I mentioned earlier that Google is one of our investors. They told us, although you can see this on Google Trends, that they're seeing as much search volume for Lemonade car insurance as they're seeing for Lemonade home insurance. We've never said the words car insurance and Lemonade. So there's a lot of pent-up demand out there, and we feel like we're letting down our customers when we say to them, oh, sorry, go to the other guys for that product. So we're very antsy. We're very impatient to cater to all of our customers' needs, not to let them down, to earn the right to capture the extra spend that is inevitably going to go somewhere, to earn the right to ensure that it comes to us over time.
Okay, fantastic. Dan, I want to thank you for just extending your time generously to share. I have so many more questions. I think I need to reach out to you again. I'm going to ask maybe for another time, or even I would love to interview Shai or even Tim, your CFO. I think you have an amazing team. Like you're just the different things that you guys all bring to the table is actually quite impressive. But I think, as a shareholder, but also as someone who's just looking, you know, for the most innovative companies out there, this conversation was fascinating. I'm sure it's going to be for many others who view it as well. So I wanted to thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for so much for all of the thoughtfulness that goes into your questions and comments. And let's definitely do it again. I'd love to do that.
I hope that interview was helpful. I had a blast chatting with Daniel Schreiber from Lemonade and appreciated his thoughtful answers. I've done several videos on Lemonade on my channel in recent months, and I'll link to them in the video description. Also, I'm planning to share more thoughts on Lemonade in coming weeks, so consider subscribing to my channel to keep updated. On my channel, we're looking at investment topics and the world through different angles, always trying to get beneath the surface of things. My YouTube videos are also on an audio podcast. Just go to your favorite podcast player and type in Dave Lee on investing. I'm active on Twitter as well at HeyDave7. We'll see you in my next video. Thanks.